This is Audible.
Once upon a time, in the latter part of the 20th century, there was a holy man who lived with several other monks in a hermitage on a mountain. When word got out about him, people came to see him during the summer months when the hermitage was accessible. First just a few, then more and more, until there was a long line climbing the steep mountain path single file, tens, hundreds, and then thousands, some of whom never made it to his door before the snows came and forced them to return home.
There was nowhere to stay, so we had to be prepared to camp, which wasn't a hardship, as the weather was warm and dry. The views were outstanding, and wild flowers flanked the path. At night, the stars were dazzling.
However, it did take strength to carry the camping gear and food, so anyone who was frail did not attempt to see the holy man, who, in any case, we knew was not a healer.
The line moved slowly, but fortunately it moved continuously. There seemed to be only a few hours every day when the holy man welcomed people into his house.
Sometimes we had to step aside for one of the monks who lived with him. Every day, one of them would come lightly up the path with supplies from the town 10 miles below.
We knew they were monks because they wore pale, wheat-coloured robes.
Those of us near the head of the line were amazed at how many pilgrims the holy man seemed to meet, given that we went in one at a time.
We never saw them once they had left the hermitage by the back door, because they went down a different path to the bottom of the mountain. The upward path was too narrow to take two-way traffic.
The hermitage was a two-story, whitewashed wooden building, built on a rock foundation. It was plain, rugged, and square, with a peaked roof.
There was no ornament. No cross on the roof, no Star of David over the door, no stone Buddha in the garden. It was a no-frills hermitage.
It faced east and was a few hundred yards from the actual mountain peak. Above the tree line, there were marvellous boulders strewn about, shaped by time and cataclysm, finished by rain, snow and wind.
At the base of one boulder, I noticed there was a small pond, the source of which was an underground spring, which I imagine provided pure water for the hermitage.
All around us, flamboyant birds and flowers adorned the grey rocks, and the sky was an unstained canvas for clouds.
When it was finally my turn, the door was opened wide, and I was summoned forth by a man in a wheat-coloured robe, a small, nondescript-looking person.
Yes?
I have come to see the holy man.
Oh, follow me, please.
I followed the small man through the house along a hallway with doorways open to various rooms. I tried to peek into them, but the little monk ahead was moving so very quickly through the house that I had to race to keep up with him. Suddenly, we were at the back door. The monk opened it wide.
Goodbye.
But I've come to see the holy man.
You have seen me.
The Man on the Mountaintop, an Audible original drama adapted from Susan Trott's The Holy Man and the Holy Man's Journey by Libby Spurrier. Starring Stanley Tucci as the narrator and Toby Jones as Joe.
This is how the holy man got to see so many people. The trip through the house was 20 seconds. And another 20 for greetings and partings, another 20 for returning to the front door, and what you have is a person a minute. Often, the holy man added another sentence, which added 7 seconds.
If you look on everyone you meet as a holy person, you will be happy.
Rushing back and forth through the house in this way was a lot of footwork for the holy man, who was 72 years old, so periodically he took 5-minute rests. Most of the pilgrims, like most people everywhere, were nice. But even the nicest among them, when the door shut on their departure, felt wronged, hurt, cheated, disappointed, betrayed, ill-used, angry.
I was shocked at how quickly I'd been shown the back door. But as I stood outside the house, I began to understand. The door had opened. There had been the little monk with a smile on his face, his eyes alight. Whereas, on reflection, I hadn't introduced myself, but had treated him like a skivvy. How pompous. I've come to see the holy man. Well, no wonder he showed me the back door pretty quickly. How could I have behaved like that? Next time I come, I will do it differently.
He tried to remember what the holy man looked like, and couldn't, because he hadn't looked at him. But from now on, he would be gracious to everyone, imagining that everyone indeed had holiness in him. Because that was what he had learned from the holy man, and it was a huge, wonderful, staggering lesson. It meant that he himself was somehow a holy person. His heart swelled, and he went down the mountain path, exulting.
I have seen the holy man.
I have seen the holy man. Sometimes, years later, the face of the holy man would come into my mind, like a photograph developing, and I would feel a catch in my throat, the pricking rush of tears to my eyes. Every year from then on, I felt more and more moved by my visit to the holy man. Amazing. It changed my life.
I have seen the holy man.
There was one pilgrim who, when the door was shut behind him, became enraged. His blood, in a tumult, rushed to his brain, breaking blood vessels in the whites of his eyes.
Let me back in! You can't do this to me! Who do you think you are, you phony? You fraud! You pipsqueak!
He got angrier and angrier, then went stomping down the steps, flailing his arms, looking for something to harm, to break, a rock to throw, flowers to trample. But his red eyes were too blind with rage to see a rock, a stick, or a flower. So he roared louder, calling up every vile, profane, and foul word he knew. And he had many at his command, for this sort of temper tantrum was not new with him. What was new was being alone. There was no one to cower fearfully before his wrath, no one to try to placate him, shudder, turn ashen-faced, and infuriate him further. But now, an echo was coming back to him from the hills across the valley. For the first time, he heard how he sounded, and he was ashamed. He was a man of learning, an appreciator of the arts, a philanthropist, a leader of men. Now he saw himself in all his brutishness. He was horrified, and he was cured.
I sat down on a rock to rest before my descent to the town. The rock was smooth and sun-warmed. Several round gray birds, which they said the holy man called boulder birds, arranged themselves in a ragged line and struck up a chorus of trills, as if for my benefit. It was lovely. The reason I went to see the holy man was because of my temper. So now I'm feeling much happier and very grateful.
One of the pilgrims was an alcoholic. When he arrived, having walked the 9 miles up from town, the line was a mile long. He hadn't understood the situation, and so he hadn't brought enough drink to last him until he got to see the holy man. He put down his half-empty bottle.
Excuse me, madam. Could you save my place in the line? I've forgotten something.
No, we can't save places for people. It wouldn't be fair. No one would know how far back they were in the line if we did that. We'd start going backwards instead of forwards.
He dimly grasped the concept, but it didn't keep him from asking other arrivals if they would save his place in line. He was a charming young man, but no matter how he cajoled and wheedled, no one agreed. The rules of the line were no saving, except for answering the calls of nature, for which purpose shovels were available, 100 yards away to the left or right. No bribing, and, of course, not a chance of butting in.
At some point, the line will break for the day, and people will set up their camps for the night. You could go down to the town and be back in time to take your place when the line forms in the morning.
You mean I won't get to see the holy man today?
Don't you see how long the line is?
Well, yes, it looks pretty long, but...
It isn't like a cinema where you suddenly all go in at 7 or 9 o'clock. He sees us one at a time. He has other things to do.
It looks like maybe I won't get to see him tomorrow either.
So maybe, when the line breaks, I'll race back to town and bring enough booze for 2 or, at the outside, 3 days. That'll be heavy. Life is very hard. Also, we're talking 18 miles here.
At 4 o'clock, the line broke, and he dashed down to the town, arriving at 6:15, making such good time that it would allow for his return before darkness, which was not until almost 10. He went to a bar, had a few drinks, and decided not to try to go back that night.
I'll go up again in the morning. It'll mean being farther back in the line, but so what?
He woke up in the morning, and besides the usual grinding headache, his quadriceps were killing him. He remembered his headlong rush down the mountain. He could hardly walk. He waited for the off-license to open, bought 3 bottles, and started up the long mountain path at 9:30.
It took me 6 hours because it was steep, because of my quads, because I had to have a drink on the way and did a great deal of stumbling and backsliding during the last 2 miles.
Now he was a lot farther down the line. He could tell because the woman he talked to yesterday was about 100 yards ahead. The line broke a half hour after he arrived, and while everyone set up their camps for the night, he sat down and drank.
Just to let you know, we're leaving a space around you. You smell terrible.
Oh.
Well, you won't last long at this rate.
Indeed, in 2 days, he was out of drink again, and it dawned upon him that he'd have to make another night run. He was sober enough to realize that if he was ever going to see the Holy Man, he'd have to go down and return in one fell swoop. He'd better load up on food, too.
Luck was with me that day. The line broke earlier than usual. I marked my place with an old handkerchief and hightailed it down the mountain. When I got to town, I bought food, some clothes, and a blanket, so I only had room in my pack for 1 bottle of booze. 2 days later, I was out of booze again. At this stage, I vaguely began to grasp that this visit to the Holy Man entailed a bit more time than I'd first realised. Still, now that I knew that I was capable of the run to town and back, I felt fine. What's more, I realised I was beginning to enjoy my companions, even though none of them were fellow drinkers. So, next time I went in town, I offered to bring back any stuff people needed.
A month later, I opened the door of the hermitage in response to a knock, and on the doorstep was a tall, muscular man with a joyful light in his clear eyes and a smile as big as a song.
Oh, Holy One, I am so happy.
Now, cut that out. Stop kissing my robe. Get up and tell me about it.
He told his tale from the beginning in a rush of words, much like his rush down the mountain, because he didn't want to take too much of the Holy Man's time.
So before I knew it, I was going to town every few days, getting things for people who needed them, and I wasn't buying booze at all. And I got so I could cover the distance faster and faster. Now I can go down in an hour and up in 2. It must be a record, don't you think?
The Holy Man smiled. It was almost as fast as he and his monks did it, or, to be honest, as fast as he did it up until a year or two ago.
This is truly a wonderful story.
That line is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
I'm delighted for you. And what will you do now?
Well, I like doing things for people. Do you think I could be of help somewhere?
Almost anywhere. Is there anything you want to ask me?
I originally came to see you because I had so many questions, but now I've forgotten them all.
Oh, goodbye then, and safe journey.
Goodbye, and thank you with all my heart.
I didn't do anything.
One day, a lovely but highly strung woman in her early 30s knocked on Joe's door.
Hello. My name is Eleanor. I hope I'm not disturbing you.
Not at all. Please, come in.
Are you the Holy Man?
Yes, I am. My name is Joe.
How good of you to come to the door yourself. May I talk with you for just a few minutes?
Sit down here with me.
Thank you so much. I'm just a poor, foolish woman who doesn't deserve a moment of your time, but you see, I'm so afraid. I'm afraid of death. Not the act of dying itself, but of being dead. When I think of it, I feel complete panic. I feel such dread, such horror. It paralyzes me.
Because life and death are interdependent. So, your fear of death has become a fear of life. And now you're unable to live.
Yes. As I sit here before you, I am as well as I've ever been because of all the fresh air and exercise I had simply in getting here. Normally I can't even leave my house.
What you're feeling is existential anxiety, and it's perfectly normal. But some people who are more sensitive than others, more creative perhaps, feel this anxiety more excruciatingly. This fear of non-being. And why not? It is quite unacceptable that one day we will simply come to an end of our existence. But there you are. We will. It is inescapable. It is our sorry lot.
But why can't I come to grips with it? I can't bear to suffer this ongoing terror.
Let me suggest that when you think about non-being, instead of letting your mind scramble away in terror like a rat into its hole, do this. Remain still and calm. Take deep breaths. Look at your inevitable death. Reflect upon it. Do this every day. Make it a practice to dwell upon your eventual non-being. And gradually, let it be absorbed by your courage. To have our courage ready at hand, we have to draw upon it regularly. We have to give it something to do.
This all sounds very difficult.
Yes, it is difficult.
I thought you would... well...
make it easy? Tell you that you were going to heaven, or readying yourself for another life, or going to join the great spirit of the universe? Well, maybe you are. None of us knows. We only know that we cease to exist here on Earth. And yes, it will not be easy to build up your courage. But you will have a most wonderful reward right away. You will begin to enjoy your life, to use your life. Your recognition and acceptance of death, why not call it your new friendship with death, will enable you to live fully.
If I had a faith...
Yes. Yes, that can be very helpful. True faith is a blessing. However, if you throw yourself into a religion just so that your anxiety will be relieved, you'll give up your freedom.
Freedom?
We want to free our minds, to come into harmony with the universe, so as to be able to see into the true nature of things.
Yes.
Which embracing dogma prevents. You've started along the path. You are already a kind person. Now be courageous, and in time, you will also be wise.
I will try. Thank you with all my heart. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Joe watched the woman start down the precipitous path. She turned to wave, smiling a small, brave smile.
I'm not really the holy man. I'm the holy chatterbox.
One day, Joe opened the door to a pair of lovers who were holding hands as if inseparable.
Hello, holy man.
It's fascinating that lovers seem to have no trouble recognizing me for who I am.
We met in the line and fell in love. Isn't it wonderful? We're going to be married. Has such a thing happened here before?
Yes, it happens all the time.
Will you give us your blessing?
Yes. No. Don't kneel down. And don't bow your heads. Just look at me. I wish you happiness. Be kind to each other and to others. Work hard together. Keep learning about the world. And when you're reading a magazine or a newspaper, consider reading a novel or poetry. And when you're reading a novel, consider reading a book on astronomy or bird behavior. Use your mind to the hilt. You know, life passes quickly, and towards the end, gathers speed like a freight train running downhill. The more you know, the more you enrich yourselves and others.
Oh, thank you. We'll try. And could we ask one more favour? We want to name our baby after you. Could you tell us your name?
Joe.
Oh. Well, we'll make the best of it.
The holy man couldn't count the number of new lovers who had come to his door, hands clasped together, men and women, two women or two men, young or old or mixed ages, different races or nationalities, some who couldn't speak each other's language. It was a loving, passionate line.
May I sit down?
Yes, of course. You're the next.
I've lost my wife. She's been taken from me. She's gone. And I loved her so much. Now I'll never see her again.
Did she die?
Yes.
She could have left, and that would have been worse. Then you would still never see her again, but have to suffer the added pain of rejection. But this is very sad. I'm so sorry that you had to give her back before she gave you back.
Well, I beg your pardon. Give her back?
You're adding to your grief by being such a victim. If you tell yourself that you have given her back, you'll feel better. Because she was never yours. Nothing that you have is yours. And it never was yours.
Oh, but that's crazy. My possessions are mine. My children are mine. My wife...
No, they're not yours. Only you are yours. Not your possessions, not your children, not your wife. You'll have to give them all back. You don't get to keep any of them.
Once there was a man, famous throughout the world, who particularly wanted to see the holy man. He told his personal assistant to make all the arrangements for the visit. However, the PA was unable to contact any of the holy man's people. There was no phone at the Hermitage. The only mailing address was a box number in the town.
Go to the town with the box number and work from there.
The PA arrived in the town below the Hermitage and discovered that there was no one with whom he could make arrangements for his boss's audience with him. He called home. The famous man was firm.
Look, what do I pay you for? Go to the holy man's place yourself and make an appointment for him to see me on a certain day, and I'll try to be there. Although, if at all possible, I'd prefer for him to come and see me.
But, sir... It's apparently 10 miles up and 10 miles down again. It's what they call a path, a mountain path.
Do it.
The PA hadn't walked farther than a city block in years. It was hard going. After a mile, he shed his coat and tie. After another mile, he loosened his shoes and his belt and rolled up his sleeves. After the third mile, he sat down and tried not to cry. His entire body was trembling. He massaged his poor muscles, then steeled himself and got to his feet. At this point, the path traveled alongside a fence, which surrounded a field, within which were about 30 dappled ponies. The PA saw several men sitting on the fence.
Hey, you there. Can I rent a pony from you? Look, I've got money here. Take it.
There was no saddle or bridle, but the pony seemed to know her job and trotted ebulliently up the trail, appearing to enjoy going uphill, which, in fact, was what she had been bred for. It was late in the day when he reached the end of the line. He dismounted. His legs crumpled beneath him, but he quickly recovered his footing. He walked over to the last person in the line.
Excuse me, ma'am. I have to go on ahead to make arrangements with the holy man to see...
Then he whispered the name of his famous boss.
Oh, no, you don't. You get right here at the end of the line and you wait your turn like the rest of us.
But you must have heard of him.
Yes, sure I have. Everyone has. And I'm impressed, truly, but the holy man doesn't care who is who.
I'd be willing to pay you and anyone else to let me buy. You can name your price.
Suppose I do decide to let you buy for $1,000, and so does the next person and the next person. You've got maybe 1,000 souls here.
Did you say 1,000?
Right. So that's 1,000 thousands. I think it's 1,000,000. Is your boss ready to pay that?
Yes.
Well, money isn't important to us. Sorry. That's not why we're here.
The PA felt it was one thing to pity himself, as he had been doing all day, but quite another to be pitied by this woman.
Why are you here, then?
To find out how to live a meaningful life.
Baby, with money, you can afford all the meaning you want.
Is money going to give you courage, wisdom, compassion?
Fast cars, women, beautiful houses, respect.
Those are unnatural and unlimited desires. They never satisfy. They do not bring happiness. You know what they bring?
What?
Despair.
If you already know so much about what it takes, courage, wisdom, and whatever, love, I guess you said, then why bother to come all this way to the holy man?
To see what it looks like when it's embodied. To see that it's... humanly possible.
When the line broke for the day, people marked their spots and drifted off to be by themselves or to mingle with friends or to set up camp.
Hey, who's that woman in the wheat-colored robe? She's going up the path. How come?
Because she lives at the Hermitage. She's one of the monks.
The next day, back in the town, I called my boss and told him how stubborn the people of the line were.
Then, sir, there are the monks. Every few days, one of them goes down the mountain to get stuff. Fresh fruit and vegetables. They take turns.
Get one of the monks to take a message to the holy man that I want to see him.
I already tried to. She wouldn't do it. She says you have to come here and get in line like everyone else, but that probably, at this time of year, you won't make it to the top. She says to come in the late spring.
I want to see the holy man now. Not next spring, not next Sunday. Now. Get hold of one of the monk's robes, and I'll go tripping the hell up the mountain myself. When the holy man sees that it's me, he'll understand. He'll forgive me. That's what he's all about, isn't he? Understanding? Forgiveness?
Yes. And he's also about courage, wisdom, and compassion.
What the hell are you talking about? What do you know? Just do your job and get the robe. I'm on my way.
He's about humility. Harmony, reason, truth.
But the famous man had already hung up. 4 days later, he arrived and ensconced himself in a room at the inn. The PA watched out for the next monk who came to town. He grabbed him by the arm and led him unprotesting to the famous man's room.
Hi, I'm sorry about this. I've got to borrow your robe to see the holy man. I promise you he'll understand when he sees who I am.
Oh, who are you?
Tell him who I am.
Vasiwaziji.
Oh. Well, maybe your assistant should steal a robe too, so as to be with you when you arrive, and then he can tell the holy man who you are.
Don't be a wise guy. Take off your robe. Let's get this over with.
The monk did not take off his wheat-colored robe. The famous man quickly shed his own clothes down to his underwear.
Get the robe.
The PA stepped forward, but could go no farther. To his astonishment, he found he wouldn't do it.
No! I can't do it! There is a line I will not cross, and this is it. I will not undress this man, not for any amount of money.
Then you're fired.
I don't care.
Suit yourself. Come on, old fella. Let's get this over with.
He leaned down, grabbed the hem of the robe, and started pulling it up over the monk's body. But the monk would not obligingly raise his arms, so So the famous man gritted his teeth, raised his hand, and struck him down. The famous man pulled the robe from the body of the half-conscious monk. He pulled on the clean, soft cotton robe, which came to a little below his knees.
I'm sorry, but I just have to see the holy man.
I think this time I won't say to him, but you've already seen him.
After the famous man had left, I lifted the little monk gently onto the bed and washed the blood from his face. I will carry him, if need be, back to the monastery or whatever it's called. Yes, I will crawl on my hands and knees and let him ride on my back if necessary, to get him safely home.
The PA knelt by the bed with his hands clasped, his head bowed, face washed by continuously running tears, feeling unutterable remorse for having participated in such a loathsome act as battering this poor, small, old monk, who was now revealed to be very old and small indeed. Joe drifted off to a healing sleep and woke up an hour later, feeling refreshed.
I'm feeling fine now. Could I please borrow some clothes?
Here are some jeans and a polo shirt. I'd like to give you everything I have, including money.
All I want is the clothes. You will want your money. Don't forget, you've lost your job.
I've lost everything, including my self-respect.
Just continue to be as kind to people as you've been to me, and you'll be a happy man.
But what did I do exactly?
Well, you took care of me. A complete stranger. You bathed my wounds and watched over my sleep. You prayed for me. You offered me all that you had. You showed courage, standing up to your boss and risking your job.
I should have protected you from him. I should never have let this horrible thing happen in the first place.
It was my fault. But I think some good has come of it. I wish you well. Goodbye.
The famous man left the town at once and bounded up the mountain. After 5 miles, he stopped bounding and walked. He looked silly in the robe that came only to his knees. He had tied a yellow scarf around his head to cover his famous hair and look more like a monk. But this only added to his bizarre appearance. The famous man arrived at the hermitage. When his knock was unanswered, he walked on in and found the dining room where 7 men and women in wheat-colored robes, all with shaved heads, were eating their lunch in silence. These people were friends of Joe's, whom he had known when he lived in the world. Every year they spent the summer with him. This summer, the group consisted of a scientist named Maria, a cellist named Ho, Henri, a lawyer, Kim, a young marathoner, a chef named Helena, Ed, a poet, and Daniel, a dancer. In the autumn, they would return to their own countries and to their work, with their minds sharpened and their hearts full. In the meantime, they shaved their heads and wore the same robes so as to be part of the community. What the famous man saw were 7 humble, bald monks. They might have been the 7 dwarves, for all he cared. He mistook their grave, horrified looks for astonishment at his appearance in their midst.
Yes, it's me. Here, I'll take off my scarf so you can see my hair. Yeah, you can believe your eyes, folks. I know, it's pretty amazing. What? Oh. Why are you pointing at me? Are you wondering about the robe? Well, you see, I had to get right up here to see the holy man, and I did the only thing I could, which was to take the robe from your little friend down in the town. That allowed me free passage up the trail.
No.
Oh, well, no harm done, I assure you. The holy man will understand when I explain. If you'll only let me see him. My time is damn precious. Are you guys silent all the time? Don't you ever say anything? What do you want? The robe? Okay, no problem. I'll take it off. Here. Oh. Have you got something else I can put on? I'd really like something to wear when I see the holy man.
Get out of here!
Hey, hey, what are you doing? Stop pushing me. Wait a minute. I didn't come all the way up here to be treated like this. Do you know who I am? Okay, I see you're angry with me. Let me talk to the man in charge. Hello? Holy man? I'm here. Your crummy minions are preventing me from seeing you.
The monk who had the robe held it up in the air at the level it would be if Joe were inside it.
Oh, no. No. No, you're not trying to tell me it's the holy man's robe, are you?
Goodbye.
No. Oh, no. Say it isn't so. Oh, if it's so, I'll kill myself. Oh, I am the biggest jerk that ever walked on the face of the earth.
During his stumbling descent past the pilgrims dressed in his underpants, he thought only of himself and his embarrassment. The whole world would learn of the story.
I knocked out the holy man and robbed him of his robe. I'll have to go into hiding until it blows over. But it'll never blow over. I'll have to give up everything. What if I face the music and tell the story myself? Or get my people to put some spin on it. But no, it's totally untellable.
The famous man saw that his behavior had become callous in the extreme, and his attack on the monk that morning was not unusual for him, and that, had it not been the holy man, he would not have thought twice about it, let alone considered going into hiding because of it. He tried to think back to when his heartlessness had begun, but he didn't think about the small man he had brutally struck down. The holy man made his way home up the mountain. It was a beautiful day. He felt happy, free, so glad to be out and about. Now that he was older, or face it, old, his friends at the Hermitage were growing terribly protective of him.
They don't like me going off alone. They're always afraid that something's going to happen to me, that I might have a fall, or who knows what, a heart attack. Come to think of it, they were right. Something had happened to me. I've been knocked unconscious, stripped of my robe. Yet, my friends know as well as me that we can't live with fear, because that's not living at all. What happened this morning was my fault, because I didn't give up the robe. But good came of it. If the famous man hadn't struck me down, that PA wouldn't have come to his understanding of how to be.
Joe walked through the woods of clattering leaves, as he called it, which was mostly ginkgo trees. Here, because of the cascade and waterfall, there was always a breeze stirring the leaves of the deciduous trees, hence the clattering sound. He was missing the unconfined feeling of the robe, the air on his legs. He'd forgotten the discomfort of trousers. After 5 more miles, he stopped and set down his pack. He looked at the valley below. The hills beyond outlined in layers against the horizon. Around him were wild grasses, flowers, scattered rocks. Insects were everywhere, and a mockingbird perched itself on the limb of an altitude-stunted tree and sang joyously.
I was enjoying the feeling of the warm sun on my back. I leant down to one of the ubiquitous springs and drank deeply. Then I got a yellow apple out from my pack and thanked nature in the hands of men and women for providing it before I bit into it. It was a good apple. I arrived at the Hermitage in time for supper.
Oh, do you have the rice?
Oh, I'm pretty hungry tonight.
Good talking.
Evening.
Joe, hello. We're so glad to have you back with us.
Even with your black eyes and puffed up nose. What do you think the famous man came to see you about?
His egotism. He wanted a stronger ego.
You're right. When he grows stronger in his ego, he'll no longer be so egotistical. When one's ego gets strong enough, you're able to slough it off. You're free to think, to release your intuitive power. And
That's what the famous man wanted.
The long line to the Holy Man, if seen from above by an alien, could be construed to be one organism. For when the top end of it moved, the ripple of movement passed along the entire body. Indeed, each individual felt such a connection to the line, so bonded to the persons at either side of him, that it was almost hard to disperse when the word came from the hermitage that the Holy Man had stopped receiving for the day.
It was amazing, too, how word travelled like lightning up and down the line. Any little drama that had transpired among us, any accident or love affair or illumination, it belonged to us all, because we were the line.
We were individual pilgrims from all over the world, but we were also one entity with a strong solidarity. If the line was threatened, or seemed threatened, by the occasional troublemaker, crazy person or desperate person, alarm spread through its body.
All pilgrims had to be integrated, but there were those who could make the line feel anxious, unhappy, vulnerable to harm, so that the experience of being in the line, which in itself was so healing, could be blighted. At these times, the line felt imperiled, so that if seen from above, it seemed to bristle, squirm, release an ominous cloud into its atmosphere.
The impatient woman arrived early in the year when the line was not very long, maybe 200 yards. But it looked long to her.
This is ridiculous. Why, it's not even moving.
He hasn't begun seeing people yet today, but when he does, it moves pretty fast.
And meanwhile, you just stand here.
That's right, and there's no point in you standing there fidgeting.
What hours does the holy man see people, then?
It varies. It's usually between the hours of 9 and 12 in the morning, but sometimes it's between 1 and 4 in the afternoon.
He only receives us during 3 hours of the day? Well, that's terrible. This should be better organised. And look, it's 9:20 now, and we might as well be stuck in cement, so it's probably going to be the afternoon hours today, right?
Maybe.
Well, I'm not going to wait around any longer.
That's up to you.
She turned and started back down the trail. Glad to be doing something, made momentarily stupid by her impatience, deprived of reason by her overriding exasperation. However, she soon realized that the hours it would take her to walk down would be the hours if she stayed. She'd be moving up in the line when the line started to move, which could be at any minute.
But then, if I left, I wouldn't see the holy man at all. Oh, maybe I should turn back. Oh, now I don't know what to do.
Ahead of her, she saw some people coming up the path. If she was not quick to turn, they would take her abandoned place in the line.
Don't bother coming. The line's too long, and it's not even moving.
We'll carry on anyway, thanks. Oh.
There goes my place in the line. I spent several days getting here. I should be willing to spend another day waiting, but it's so hard. Getting here, I was in motion. It's the standing around that's so maddeningly difficult. Just standing there with my face hanging out, not doing anything. I didn't bring anything to read or sew. Oh, I wonder if anyone has a crossword puzzle book or a pack of cards. Oh, well, there's always charades.
She turned and hurried back up the path to the line and took her place behind the two people who had passed her.
Have you changed your mind?
Yes. I'm afraid I'm very restless. It's hard for me to be still.
Why don't you do some deep breathing? Like this, from the abdomen, concentrating on a long out-breath, letting the in-breath take care of itself. It'll relax you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it'll help to pass the time. The thing is, you see, I'm a quick learner, a perfectionist, and I pretty much excelled at everything I've done. But I've never found that one thing which would fully satisfy my restlessness. This is why I've come to see the holy man.
In no time at all, she was a champion deep breather, But this, of course, was not a career choice. The line didn't move much that day. When it was time to make camp for the night, she went about talking to people with the idea of reorganizing the system.
Why not take turns? One day the men could stand in line, another day the women. That way they'd be free to take walks or go back to town to make phone calls or do anything they wanted. Or why not figure out exactly how many people, at most, the holy man could see in 3 hours, and just those people stand in the line for that day? Or there could be a watchman assigned to stand at the head of the line and signal when the holy man began to receive the pilgrims, so we could all fall into place. Or how...
I really don't think those ideas are practical. Mainly because there are always new people arriving.
Yeah, remember the three main rules. No bribing, no saving places, no butting in. As it is, there are already rule breakers and troublemakers.
If we try anything new, it'll be anarchy. The line actually works very well as it was. I don't think your ideas move the line along any faster.
Her ears pricked up when told of the existence of troublemakers, not considering for a minute that she herself, in a minor way, was well ensconced in that category.
I work in the justice system, and I would be happy to solve any problems that came up in the line, and to keep order in general. I'm very good at that sort of thing, and it would keep me busy while I wait to see the holy man. I'm absolutely longing for something to do, or I'll go mad. So, please... send word down the line if I'm needed.
Not wanting the newcomer to go mad, they kept her busy with any problems that arose in the line. When she went to help, she lost her place and had to begin again at the end, because the strict rules applied to her as well. But it was worth it to her to lose her spot if it meant having something to do. In this way, the one who was most impatient to see the holy man never got to see him, because she was always going to the end of the line. Day after day, she made absolutely no progress, no headway. If anything, her movement was downward and backward.
But that's all right with me. I don't mind because I'm busy and useful and needed. At first, I rushed to where I was summoned, anxious to get to the job, but over time, I began to move slower and to get there just as fast, arriving serene and unruffled so that my very calmness eased the problem. I met a lot of people and made many friends. I stayed the entire summer.
At the end of the summer, there ceased to be new arrivals, and the line grew shorter every day. It looked as if she was going to get to see the holy man at last. But she decided she would rather come back to see him next year, when there would be a whole new line needing her managing and counseling abilities. She had found her career in life. Peacemaker. There was one woman in the line who was so intent on getting to the holy man that she could not think of anything else. She paid no attention to the other pilgrims, but only concentrated on the movement upwards, as if, by an exercise of will, she would get there quicker. When the line broke for the day, she went off alone, as if talking to others would only distract her from her mission and maybe abort it. She was eager to look over any newcomers, however, just as she'd been concerned upon arriving to study the people who were ahead of her. Eventually, she reached the front of the queue.
My name is Marion. As it's early in the year, I was able to reach the hermitage door in only 6 days.
When I told her who I was just ushering her out. Her eyes glittered with victory.
I did it. Can't wait to get home and tell Winnie.
Did you want to ask me something?
Oh, no, not really. I just wanted to see you.
That's what I thought. Let me ask you something, then. What is the opposite of love?
Hate, of course.
No, it is envy.
I didn't take much notice of what he said. I just couldn't wait to get home and tell Winnie I've seen him. And anyway, it's not me who's envious. It's Winnie.
Marion and her friend Winnie had been rivals since girlhood. It began by being a normal, friendly rivalry. Who had the cutest boyfriend, the prettiest dress? Then it evolved to who could marry the richest man, and, that accomplished, have the biggest house, the finest car. But as they found out, anyone could buy things.
After a while, we used to compete as to which of us could have the most interesting guest to dinner. That kept us busy for years. Winnie got a state senator once, but I got a college president.
Down through the years, it was always who could have the most wonderful vacation at the most glamorous resort, which evolved in time to who could discover the most out-of-the-way vacation, and finally evolved or disintegrated into who could have the most demanding, strenuous, and wretchedly miserable vacation, such as running a marathon or crossing a river, traveling across deserts and polar ice caps.
Neither of us really won, but then I heard about the Holy Man. By now, we were both widows and heading toward old age. I have to confess that I prayed with all my heart that Winnie didn't know about him yet. This would be the creme de la creme of accomplishments. Winnie would be green with envy, would be utterly defeated once and for all. So I made plans in secret and took off for the faraway town at the foot of the mountain.
When she got home, she did not at once tell Winnie where she had been. She was waiting for the perfect moment when poor Winnie would throw up some piddling triumph to her, and she could forthwith crush her with her paramount deed of having climbed the mountain to see the Holy Man.
Well, it was weird, because Winnie was no longer acting spiteful and jealous, no longer seeking to impress. She was actually being quite nice. I began to suspect that Winnie, too, had seen the Holy Man, and that she, too, was waiting for the perfect moment to annihilate me with the news. Or else, Winnie had seen the Holy Man and changed, had gotten some message from him, maybe the same message, maybe a different one, and become the lovely person that she seemed to be now. Well, I thought, I would show her. I was going to be an even nicer person. I went out and did good works and made a name for myself as a charitable woman. I became a regular at fundraisers, soup kitchens, settlement houses, and rehabilitation centers. I made sure my picture got in the paper so that Winnie would know.
Then she found out. Winnie was also doing good works, only quietly.
There was only one thing left. I decided to sell everything I owned and give it all to the poor. This took some while, and in the meantime, Winnie disappeared. Well, I felt quite cross. I bet she's gone to India to work with Mother Teresa, I thought. Well, good riddance to her. I'm still giving all my money to the poor. What do I want with this big old house anyway?
Deep down in her heart, however, she felt very sad to think that she might have lost her old friend, that she might never see her again. But then there was a surprise. Marion found Winnie living at the same boarding house she moved into.
I am so happy to find you, Winnie. Oh, I've missed you so much, and I love you.
I love you, too. Isn't it wonderful not to live with envy anymore, but instead to feel love for each other?
Just as I suspected. It was on the tip of my tongue to say, I saw the Holy Man, too, you know. But I didn't. Because what if by some slim chance I was wrong, and Winnie never had gone to see him? It would crush her.
I was the last customer of the day. When Joe led me to the back door and said goodbye, I was cross. I said to him, but I haven't seen the Holy Man.
Yes, you have seen me.
Oh, my dear fellow, I'm terribly sorry. I had no idea. Forgive me.
Oh, don't mention it. However, if from now on you treat everyone you meet like a holy person, you'll be happy.
I will certainly try to do that, although until now I've seen little evidence to encourage me to think of people being holy.
Well, nor did you see it just now.
Oh, quite right. So, the idea is to go on the assumption of intrinsic holiness and be a happier man for proceeding along these lines. Yes, I see. And if I'm wrong?
No, no. You won't be wrong. We are all holy.
All God's creatures, great and small, so to speak.
Well, if it helps to speak of it that way. Goodbye.
Oh, but please, now that I have your ear, could I seek your advice on my problem?
Oh, fire away.
I'm married to a lovely, intelligent, wonderful woman, and I'm consumed by jealousy about her. I'm constantly imagining that she's unfaithful to me. I'm jealous of her friends, her time, the air she breathes, the clothes on her back. It's not that I have nothing else to do or to think about. I'm an inventor and work very hard. We live far out in the country, and I always know exactly where she is and who she's with because we have a car phone, and she's required by me to carry a phone on her person. And, of course, I think nothing of having her followed. She goes along with all this for the sake of keeping the peace and because she truly loves me, despite my infuriating obsession. Even though I treat her like a virtual prisoner, I know that if she wanted a lover, she would have one. Women can always find ways, can't they?
Yes.
Exactly. So, I put myself in her mind and stay one step ahead of her. I know in my heart she doesn't want a lover, but then I think maybe I'm driving her to it.
Given this desperate situation, how are you able to leave your poor wife for such a long time to come and see me?
Well, one day I went to her room without knocking on her door, so just to surprise her in whatever suspicious action she might be engaged in, and I found her standing before the mirror with a knife in her hands. I was horrified. I thought I'd driven her to suicide or murder, but it was neither. She said she was going to disfigure herself. Then I would have nothing to be jealous about. I promised her I would cease badgering her and get help. A friend told me about you, so I came. I've been in the line a month, and it has been wonderful. My phone can't reach her from this mountain, so I have simply had to trust her. As a result, I've been released from the clutches of the green-eyed monster. For the first time in years, I'm free and at peace. I'm sure the peace and freedom she is feeling is stupendous. But now...